Welcome to Red Meat, the conservative news update you need from Odyssey stations across the country. This is the place where we're not afraid to dig in. So Jill Biden going on tour and talking about how she thought her husband was having a stroke during the Trump debate has brought up a lot of questions. None of them good. But it's also drawing attention to differences in two people, both approaching the same age. Here's more from the Mark Cox Show on Donald Trump's insane energy levels.
We had a cognitively impaired president in office a few years ago. That's a cognitively impaired president, but I don't like to talk about that because it weakens America. This president we have, this is a guy that literally doesn't sleep. He works day and night, long hours, every single day. I don't know if you haven't seen him in 8 days. I saw him yesterday. I didn't see him today, but yesterday because I was in Congress the day before. I talked to him at all hours of the day and night. He works inhumane hours. Okay, I've been on foreign trips with the president that he doesn't sleep in the whole flight. And everyone else is sleeping on the plane, and he's, you know, wandering the hallways looking for someone to wake up and talk to that people are. So I don't know what you're referring to, but he has an incredible amount of energy. I'm just telling you.
Yeah, that's Secretary of State Rubio when he was in Congress this week. And Ted Lieu, this Democrat congressman, is making these outrageous allegations that the president has disappeared from sight for 8 days and you're hiding something. And Rubio just dismantled him. We've got Kush Desai on the phone right now. He's the White House deputy press secretary. And Kush, welcome back. How are you?
Thanks for having me on. I'm doing well. How are you?
Absolutely. I'm doing fine. So I loved the way the Secretary of State described Donald Trump and his endless energy and the fact that he roams the hallways of Air Force One on foreign trips looking for somebody that's awake that he can talk to.
Yeah.
He's exactly right. I mean, I guess I'm 30, but we've got staffers here who are in their early 20s and the president's running circles around them. So, again, the president's energy levels, his health, his vitality, it's something quite to behold, if I'm being honest. He is, this president is a machine. He's got the energy. He's got the health that, again, if he's running circles around 22-year-olds, I don't know what else you could want in the president of the United States.
Kush, your boss, Caroline Leavitt, is still enjoying her maternity leave. What's it been like to work with all of these secretaries and to help them write scripts and have their talking points ready to go? I imagine everyone's a little bit of a different challenge for you guys in the press office to brief them.
Well, just like with Caroline, just as with Caroline, I think these secretaries there are smart. They're prepared. They know what's happening and they know what's going on. And so, I mean, just as with Caroline, it's honestly been pretty easy to help prep them and brief them because, again, they're on top of it and they know what's going on and they're carrying out the president's mission here.
Well, the thing that struck me about what Rubio pointed out is that these days, after what we witnessed with Joe Biden, for anyone to question what the current president's mental capacity or cognition or whatever is laughable. And there's some of them are still in denial. And apparently Jill Biden and a few others are still in denial over the shape that he was in when he was in office. And you know, we see it every day. What was the news conference he held yesterday on coal and energy production? And then he just freewheeling took questions for, what, an hour in the Oval Office?
And that's a usual occurrence around here. Yeah. I think the president's probably taken more questions than more unscripted time in front of the media probably in the past 2 months than Joe Biden did all 4 years of his presidency.
Yeah. You know, Kush, you're an Indian American, former journalist. What do you think of all these people who'd love to, you know, talk about him as a dictator and Nazi and, you know, a fascist leader? And also, you know, the race card always comes out that he's a racist. You're a minority. Do you see any of that come out? I mean, do you, the fact they keep beating this drum is just, you know, I'd love to talk to somebody who's kind of in the trenches and sees how he works with people.
I've interacted with the president personally. I've seen him interact with others personally. I think you have to kind of just ignore reality and ignore the fact that, you know, this is a president and he's always said he's the president he's the president of the United States, he's the president for every single American. And I think we see that every single day. I think in his interactions with us, I think what he cares about are results, are getting things done. And so this is a president that is focused on results. He doesn't, I think when people focus in on, you know, race or this or that, I think they're kind of erecting a scarecrow here that doesn't exist. This is a president who, again, he cares about every single American. He cares about our country as a whole. And so, and that's what he's focused on. And I think it's really the Democrats and these liberals who love making this about race when that's not at all what anyone's really thinking about here.
Yeah. We've got Kush Desai with us, White House Deputy Press Secretary. Ethan, I want to get you to play cut number 9 from the Energy Secretary Chris Wright yesterday, please.
All three of them grow during this administration. And in fact, later today, before the sun goes down, you'll see a big announcement in the nuclear space related to the trip you came on.
Thank you.
Yeah. So that news conference yesterday, Kush, dealing with the expansion, we've always said drill, baby, drill. I guess in this case, it's dig, baby, dig. We're helping out the coal industry. And I heard the president joke about the fact that in China, they built 51 coal-burning power plants last year and only made
Two windmills,
and those were for the idiots in either Europe or the U.S. that wanted to buy wind energy.
That's exactly right. I mean, I think the president is very clear that it's been a day one priority to unleash American energy, and that means coal, that means natural gas, that means oil. This president has made the United States the largest oil and gas producer in the world. I mean, think about it. 20 years ago, we were dependent on the Middle East, on other countries for our oil and gas, and today we are a net exporter of both oil and gas because of this president's energy abundance policies to unleash our God-given resources. And the thing is, when you take a step back, there's no economy in the world that has tons of energy but is poor. And there's no country that's rich but has no energy. Energy is so critical for economic growth, for our economy. I mean, not just to keep our lights on, but to run our supercomputers, to run our manufacturing facilities, to run our steel mills. And this president is making sure that energy is both abundant and affordable for American businesses and American families.
Do you have any secretaries going to be taking the podium and running the press briefings next week? Any more of the cabinet members stepping up?
You know what? I'm going to keep that a surprise for you folks.
You guys never release it. I want to see RFK, to be quite honest with you.
that one would be fun.
Switching gears from energy to outrage, Scott Pelley at 60 Minutes found out what happens when you rage at the boss. And Brian Kilmeade from Fox News joined Mark Reardon to discuss.
Have you been in a staff meeting with the leaders at Fox where you've called out management and been disrespectful and not had consequences for that? Because I think if I did that, and I do some things that aren't very, you know, probably good for my career in front of the bosses, but I think I'd probably be fired too. And that's what happened to Scott Pelley. And he had to know he was going to get fired after that, didn't he?
I mean, a little bit. I mean, I think he did. Or what makes it worse is if he thinks he's bigger than the station, bigger than the show. He is, how dare you address me? And I've met people like that. Like, how dare you? You know, you work at Fox. That's not a real network. You know, you're not even in my league. And it makes me laugh now, but when you're in your 20s and 30s, it really bothers you, perhaps. But that's the way he's been acting. I mean, I watched his commencement address last year.
Oh, I saw
it. He's just ranting, just ranting against the new owners of the network. And let alone when Barry Weiss said, hey, Sharon Alfonsi, you're about to release a segment about illegal immigrants sent to El Salvador's prison. You don't have the administration's point of view. Well, we called them and they gave us a statement. No, that's not good enough. Hold it. How dare you tell me to hold it? When I watched her erupt, I think to myself, wait, then it comes out that she's coming up to the end of her contract. And I thought, she must be making so much money or has little kids at home that she wants to spend more time with. Because in our business, everybody's expendable. You might think that, you know, Mark Reardon and Brian Kilmeade's ratings are great, he's untouchable. I know that's not true.
Oh, I know it too.
I mean, I've witnessed.
We're all. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. There's the owner of the stations. I mean, they worked hard to buy these stations. And, you know, they value. I imagine they value your employees, and that's fine. But you're employees. And there's an opportunity, maybe, for you and I to buy a station if we get investors. Well, that's different. Then, you know, we can maybe make demands on people. But you have to know who you are. I remember, you know, you're waiting tables. And I remember some waiters when I was in college and right after used to, like, yell at management. I go, guys, they're going to just fire you. I hope you have another job. And they would get fired. There's no difference now. There's owners and there's employers. And you could ask for, you know, what's due to you and your vacation days. But then you answer to them. But when I heard the arrogance of a brand-new executive producer being brought in, he just wants to say hello, and they say, I looked at your resume. You're not worthy of this job.
Yeah.
I don't think you have the experience for this job. I was stunned by that.
I was too. And I just read the entire, you know, letter that Nick Bilton wrote to Scott Pelley terminating his employment. And the thing that really frustrates me, and I'm going to address this a little bit more later in the show, but I have, there's some folks I follow on Facebook, including a former University of Missouri journalism professor that I had, Stacey Wolfel. And he writes about these media issues all the time. And they really, at my alma mater, Brian, they favor agenda journalism. They're proud of it. So he writes this piece today, heaping high praise on 60 Minutes, saying, don't watch 60 Minutes anymore. You know, Barry's murdered 60 Minutes. They just don't have an understanding of what has led millions of people in this country to not trust the legacy media. They still don't get it. And to your point, Scott Pelley does think he's bigger than 60 Minutes. He thinks he's bigger than CBS altogether. I guess he'll have a podcast and write a book or something like that, but he found out he was expendable too.
Yeah, and you know, I watched Mark him up early. And when I get to work at 4, it's also valuable time for me to go to the BBC and GBN News and find out what else is happening, especially with this war going on. Because Fox is in repeats and CNN is just talking to themselves. So and local news doesn't help me get ready for any show. So I always like flip around. So for some reason, Monday or Tuesday, I saw the Emmy Awards. And all of a sudden, I just go, I can't believe this. I go, wait, who's winning the Emmy? That's right. So it's news. I go, wow, I'm going to watch this for a second. And they introduce Scott Pelley. And he comes out, and he's all upset. He goes, Sharon Alfonsi's in the audience, give her a standing ovation. And then they introduce a 22-year-old who gets a CBS scholarship because of his journalism. Mm-hmm. Alex Tommy says, thank you. And you know what his next line is? And I'm going to play this on One Nation on Sunday. His next line is, I am condemning CBS for their new policy and what they're doing to 60 Minutes. And I think it's wrong, and you're destroying Mike Wallace, who would never accept what's happening. I go, wait, this is a 22-year-old kid who just got like $100,000 from CBS. And the crowd stood and cheered. And I'm saying to myself, you should always, one of the words of the lines was, you should never be afraid to say genocide. So you know what they're saying? You should never be afraid to call it genocide in Gaza. You know what? It's not. And if you don't believe me, ask X, Y, and Z. And there are people that do. Your job is to report. Not to tell everybody it's genocide in your point of view. And now another 22-year-old is doing a mini Jimmy Kimmel rant when a time in which you should just say one, two words, thank you.
I mean, I could not be more with you. And it's just, it's amazing to me that, you know, there's so much. And I don't know where this takes us because, look, I say this all the time, and I know that you are a national show, but we feel like local live radio and local reporting is still very important, and we're losing that because of the lack in trust. I mean, I have another example even from the Post-Dispatch today where it's just omission, you know, little things that they omit that affect the story and also lead to bias.
And when people distrust the media, they can start to distrust their country. Here's Tara Servatius on the state of patriotism.
Do you remember when Democrat Senate candidate out of Texas, James Tallarico, said, it's in that ad that they're playing, that the American flag makes us uncomfortable? Who's us? The left. Why does it make you uncomfortable? Things you don't like make you uncomfortable. But saying out loud never helped you win a Democrat primary before. Until now. Remarkable polling by Scott Rasmussen shows what we've always intrinsically suspected. Here's what he found. Progressives who prefer the policies of AOC and Bernie Sanders have a more favorable opinion of France, 81% favorable, and the UK, 79% favorable, and Germany, 67% favorable, than they do of the US, just 57% favorable. They hate America, folks. This is why it's so striking to me when they have their little protests, no kings or whatever silly thing they're doing. They carry flags, but never the American flag. It's always the pride flag. Never the American. Why? Because as Tallarico said, it makes me uncomfortable. Well, why are you running for office in America then? Move. I don't know, go to France or something. Remarkable analysis by Christian Hines on this. And this is so true. It's actually kind of profound. Democrats only have any sort of sentimental attachment to America when they feel like they have total ideological control over it. Because they're liberals, and liberals ultimately have no nation of their own. Trump didn't drain the soul out of anything. He didn't destroy the country. Democrats, they keep telling us he did, that he changed. He didn't. Democrats just adopted an ideology that dissolves the nation and leaves its own adherents increasingly atomized and mentally ill. But wow, that's profound. And he posts this from Gallup, and it's remarkable, folks. Go back to 2001, not that long ago, okay? You proud of your country? 90% of Republicans said yes. 87% of Democrats said yes. This is 2001. 84% of independents. Fast forward to today, 2025, they just asked this question again. And what do you find? Well, nothing's changed with the Republicans. In fact, we love our country a little more. 92% say, yes, I'm very proud of my country. What is it for Democrats? 36%. Just 36% say they're proud of their country. It was 87% in 2001. Where are independents? They're at 53%. And so this is why you're seeing these candidates win in these primaries. If you're an immigrant, then that helps. That means you're not an American. If you're not from here, that is better than being from here. That's why they like immigrants. If you're an immigrant who hates America, you're going to win. I mean, you're on fire, man. You're going to win that primary. And that's what this poll shows. And overwhelmingly, voters on the left wing, this is from hotair.com, voters on the left wing, the Democrat Party, are not that fond of America and have attitudes far more akin to Europeans than most Americans. France is more their cup of tea, which is pretty amazing since the French are having enormous political and economic problems and are now seen as the sick man of Europe. Unsurprisingly, they also view the UK quite favorably as the country is riven by massive differences between the political elite and ordinary Britons, who they're grounding underfoot. They view Germany less favorably, but still favor it more than the United States. Our culture has changed so much, they are a people without a home. Republicans have a home. It's America. And the difference is that we love the country, whether we're in charge or not. This mirrors, they write, a larger trend among Democrats that they only like America when they run it. What seems to distinguish the socialist wing of the party is that they don't even like America that much when the Democrat Party has the power because they think it is systematically flawed and its political and economic systems must be replaced. You will notice that in the Gallup polling, Republicans' pride in their country is not determined, again, by whether they have political power at any moment, because their pride is directed at the system, not the people in office. This is a fundamentally different way of viewing what makes America America. Yes, because in socialist countries, communist countries, what is the center of the country? It is not a system. It's not a set of values. It's the party. I tell you this all the time. It's the party. This is why in communist China, there are only 9 holy commandments. You go into a church, you go into a Catholic church, they're listed there. There's only 9. There's not 10. And I say this to people, which one do you think they got rid of? My first guess, and theirs is always the same. Well, thou shalt not kill, because China kills a lot. No. They left that one. Well, what one? The first commandment. Thou shalt have no God before me. Why? The party is the God, the Alpha, the Omega, the center of life. And this is what this poll shows. They hate America when they're not in charge. One more reason why. Let me tell you why. Because for us, we want less government. We want to be free. We want people off our backs. So we're happy when we're not in power, and we're happy when we're in power. They want to rule with an iron fist, or they can't be happy until they tell everyone, everywhere, what to do, what to think, what to wear, what to do, all day long. Or they can't be happy because they need power to do that. For us to be happy, we need a lack of power. And that is the difference.
Back to policy. Let's catch up on Iran from Mark Cox.
So if they're backed into a corner and you look at the Strait of Hormuz, is that an option for them to block that?
If they block the Strait of Hormuz, we will take out literally all their military on the Strait of Hormuz. That's an act of war if they pull a stunt like that. And they know what the results of that will be. And that will push the United States into conflict. Iran does not want conflict with the United States. Remember, 38 years of conflict, all using proxies, avoiding direct confrontation with their own military. That is one thing. Despite the fact that they harass our ships, they'll fire a missile here and there, they do not want that kind of conflict.
Wow, that's General Jack Keane talking yesterday there on Fox about what should happen next, potentially, in Iran. Let's get to our guest right now. Andrew Harding back with us, Senior Associate for National Security at the Heritage Foundation. Andrew, how are you?
I'm doing well. How about yourself?
I'm doing all right. What's your reaction to what General Keane said there? I mean, I think that militarily, there's no reason we couldn't keep the strait open. They've had the minesweepers over there for a while now, is my understanding of it. What remains the challenge?
Well, the challenge remains that the IRGC continues to pose a threat to the region. Now, to be clear, the U.S. military absolutely has the superiority across the strait. We're seeing it maintain a blockade on Iran's ports. And it's very clear that the Iranian Navy has been completely sunk at this rate. So the U.S. has that advantage throughout the strait and around Iran's waters. The problem, however, is that the IRGC can still fire missiles or rockets if it so chooses. And as you're mentioning here, there are some attempts to get some mines out. So even if it's unsuccessful, the threat of having mines try to be laid in the strait, or there could be any tit-for-tat missile exchanges, is enough to threaten off private vessels or different tankers from transiting through the strait. However, I think it's clear that, as the general said, if Iran did try to pull a full closure of the strait, however it would try, this is something President Trump would not allow to go further in any negotiations.
Well, Andrew, when you talk about military strategy, and if indeed we go back to, you know, this ceasefire fails and we have to go back into an attack mode, isn't Karg Island like the number one strategic site? Even though it's not at the choke point of the strait, it is the nerve center of really everything Iran does militarily as well as economically, right?
It certainly has a lot of value when it comes to the oil exports that Iran has, with a roughly 90% of Iran's oil that would be shipping through the strait goes through Karg Island. Additionally, they have various different storage facilities there and then different deposits, which allows oil to be sent through in and out the strait. So what matters there is that it is an option for President Trump that if he so chose to escalate further, Karg Island could certainly be a spot. And he has targeted it before. He's focused on the military installations and sites there, but he intentionally stayed clear from the oil deposits to make very clear a message to Iran that the U.S. has the ability to escalate if it so chose, but intentionally decided to hold off at that time. So I think if the president wanted to escalate, it would certainly hurt the Iranians and their ability to try to get oil throughout the strait.
Yeah, we're talking to Andrew Harding from the Heritage Foundation. I know this is probably something they do at think tanks. So let me ask you this question. Let's look ahead 3 months from now, 6 months from now, maybe a year from now, and assume that some sort of an agreement gets reached. Hostilities cease. The strait technically gets opened again. What is the long-term result here, Andrew, in your opinion, of the relationship among all of these countries, which has been very strained now in that region? Like, when you're having Iran bombing what used to be countries it was fairly friendly with, just because they don't like the fact that they were siding with the United States in this in some manner, what does that look like going forward? Are these new coalitions that have already been developed because OPEC's falling apart?
Well, I think we will be seeing some changes in how the political lines and coalitions are drawn, to your point. First, I'm thinking about, say, the U.S. and Iran. My key question, if I'm thinking months down the road here, is, yes, a deal can be reached, but would the IRGC allow it to be implemented? If it is true that there are ongoing regime tensions, it is possible to get a deal across the line, and the U.S. can enforce Iran to follow through, but the IRGC may not make it easy to do that. They may try to continue to make sure the strait is threatened. So that, to me, is a first flashpoint, and then months ahead of how U.S.-Iranian relations go. Second, on Israel and Lebanon, which is also becoming an ongoing question, in which we've got Hezbollah, in which it continues to try to violate a ceasefire, that it won't put its arms down, and continues to be a threat in northern Israel, with Iran trying to link that to broader agreements. However, Israel and Lebanon, the governments, are now cooperating and speaking in a manner, in a way they haven't done for years. And so this is a new level in which they have a shared interest in preventing Hezbollah from becoming or being this terroristic threat that is drawing conflict into northern Israel and southern Lebanon. Third, then, is to the broader Gulf. I think exactly as you mentioned, Gulf countries realize they've long been wary of Iran and not been pleased towards it. But with Iran's actual firing of missiles, it's going to be very hard for Gulf countries to reconcile with it and to view it as a potential positive partner in the region. So I think you'll see Gulf countries work more closely with the U.S. and Israel over time.
And without the OPEC limits on production, too, we could see a real uptick in total crude oil on the market, which should drive prices down, right?
Well, especially with the UAE leaving. In the UAE, this has been something they've long considered, but they finally pulled the trigger. And so what that allows them to do is take more control of their own oil production, their own ability to meet demand, to expand, shrink supplies they so need. But that works very closely with the United States. The U.S. and UAE have been cooperating more closely over technological developments, AI, but also in the energy space. Qatar as well is making big investments in Texan oil as well. So actually, when Qatar's oil fields have been hit by Iran, they haven't had as big of an impact as they could have, because that's when they've had pipelines in Texas come online to ensure that U.S. oil is being purchased and used, but it's ensuring that their economy is able to be sustained. So there's a lot of future cooperation here I'm optimistic about.
Yeah, that's great.
That is great.
And here's a little something to think about from Bob Rose.
Authorities in New York have busted a truck cargo hijacking ring allegedly run by Uzbek national Murad Kasanov. Yep, they say that he and his associates stole at least $4.5 million in cargo. Manhattan District Attorney's Office handed down indictments for Kasanov and seven of his associates in a scheme using warehouse insiders who passed the crooks tips about what sort of cargo was being stored in the facilities. And with that insider info, the crooks forged fake transit papers and simply drove in, picked up the merchandise, and then drove off without any questions asked. But they finally did get busted, and that is your smoking gun. Sometimes crime doesn't pay.
Thank you for listening to Red Meat, a collection of conservative audio from Odyssey's talk stations across the country. This is the place where we're not afraid to dig in, listen wherever you get podcasts, and smash that subscribe button.